Hi, I'm Arish Shah, host of the Nothing Ventured podcast. As a CFO that has operated in the startup and scale-up ecosystem for the last decade, and as a founder myself, I found it absolutely essential to learn from those that have come before me. So this podcast is an exploration of the people, the characters, the stories, and the narratives that make the venture ecosystem go round. From emerging fund managers to established VCs, from angel investors to founders, I chat to people that make the tech ecosystem thrive. Please remember to like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast because it really helps with our discoverability. And in the meantime, I hope you enjoy the pod. In today's episode, I spoke to Alexander Mann. Alex is a partner at TimeChain, a VC fund focused on Bitcoin that exists to redress the widening funding gap between Bitcoin infrastructure projects and the wider crypto ecosystem. In this episode, we talked about the fact that the blockchain was truly established in 1991, why Bitcoin provides private property rights, how gold cannot move at the speed of information, and what is the future for currency in nation states? Let's get straight into it. Alex, great to have you here with me today in the studio.
Thank you.
So we're going to go pretty deep, I think, into a few topics here, because I think there's still quite a lot of smoke and mirrors around the whole crypto, blockchain, Bitcoin space. You've mentioned that blockchain is not useful at all and that it's just a marketing gimmick. Can you elaborate on why you believe this to be the case? And for our audience, kind of break down why TimeChain exists and why it's focused on Bitcoin technology instead.
Yeah, sure. Quite a lot to say here, but maybe just at the outset, just reiterate the point that you made that, yeah, we believe the word blockchain is essentially just a marketing gimmick and has no practical applications whatsoever. The long and short of it is that whoever the creator of Bitcoin was used blockchain as a technology in combination with several other technologies. So proof of work, which is the consensus mechanism, SHA-256, which underpins encryption on the internet, Merkle trees, and a range of other technologies, and created something called the time chain. Mm-hmm. And that's basically why we're called time chain. And there is only one time chain, it's Bitcoin. And so if you read the white paper written by the founder of Bitcoin before that person or group disappeared, they never even used the word blockchain. Mm-hmm. In the code base, Bitcoin is referred to as the time chain. Mm-hmm. And I have a physics background, so I kind of enjoy this aspect of it, which is essentially how you tell the flow of time. So in the real world, you tell the flow of time through the second law of thermodynamics. It's called entropy, so mm-hmm. things decay.
Yeah.
So, you know, a chair doesn't spontaneously combust itself. If you leave it for 1,000 years, it'll decay into its constituent atoms. That's how you tell the flow of time in the real world. Entropy always increases, disorder always increases. In the physical world, you can't, because the laws of physics don't exist in the digital world, sorry. And so what you need is a timestamp sequence of events. That's the time chain, that's what Bitcoin is, and that's what it provides. So it kind of hints at its broader applicability in a world where the digital sphere is consuming more of our time and energy. And so going back to blockchain, what a blockchain is just a slow and expensive database. Mm-hmm. And a blockchain was actually first theorized in about 1991. That's when the first computer science papers mentioning a blockchain were published, and nobody ever found a use for them. Until this person, Satoshi, you know, combined them with a bunch of technologies.
But never talked about them in terms of blockchains. So, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And so, you know, over the last 10 or 15 years, well, a bit less, about 10 years, venture capital firms have been very successful at creating these tokens and using this word blockchain as a marketing gimmick to sell these alternate tokens or change to relatively unsuspecting public or even some institutions. And because tokens or crypto at large is not subject to security legislation, because it operates in this gray space at least until last week, mm-hmm. you could basically promise anything. You could say, you know, this was a token for building Google on the blockchain, or quantum computing on the blockchain, or AI on the blockchain, whatever you want. And it didn't matter. And you just, essentially how it would work is you create this new blockchain, you know, let's say it's AI on the blockchain, and then you raise a bunch of money from VCs, say $10 million, you spin up this token for zero cost, you pump that $10 million into a marketing scheme, and then you sell your tokens for $1 or $1.50 or whatever, promising whatever you want, because again, it's not subject to security legislation.
Yeah.
and you've made, you know, 100x. And so this was actually, you know, the greatest VC gravy train, the greatest business model for VCs ever for the last 10 years. Something we stayed clear of because we've, you know, had a very clear sort of view on this. Again, a blockchain isn't useful. Bitcoin is where the vast majority of the innovation and value is going to accrue over the medium to long term.
Yeah. And I think you've also talked about this. I mean, in that wider crypto space, everything goes to zero. I mean, essentially, because there is no value, right? So I mean, the way I always looked at it, I guess, for the last 3-4 years with a sort of perplexed look on my face, thinking, well, this feels a bit like a Ponzi scheme. It feels like a greater fool theory in practice, but for the whole world to see. And this was kind of even further exacerbated by the fact that you had a lot of celebrities getting involved in these projects, which was clearly purely to market, you know, the coin. And in fact, even in some of the kind of, you know, WhatsApp chats and so on that I've been in, you would see people saying, this is going to be a great, you know, this is a great coin, just wait until this happens and then we're going to sell and then we'll be able to pick them up again on the secondary when everything drops down again. Right. So it felt like a lot of manipulation throughout the whole process.
Well, you can see there's if you go to like CoinMarketCap, I think it's the most popular website to see all the crypto projects. There's something like 25,000 crypto projects now that are listed on that website. The sixth most popular one out of 25,000 is a literal joke crypto called Dogecoin.
Dogecoin, yeah.
It's a literal joke.
Yeah.
It was invented for just joke purposes.
Yeah.
And it's the sixth biggest one. So the next 24,994 are worse than that.
And Dogecoin, to be fair, I mean, has been pumped by Elon.
Sure.
Partly for his own jokes, but also who knows for whatever other reason. But again, it is the epitome of that whole kind of marketing scam sort of situation, I guess, right?
Exactly, yeah. I can make one more point on this that hopefully just sort of helps illustrate why Bitcoin is different. Again, if you look at all those cryptocurrencies and you take, you know, the market cap of the next 30, 40, 50 combined, there will be less than the market cap of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
So that's telling you something interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Second point to note is that venture capital firms have pumped maybe at least $100 billion into those chains, and they still haven't been able to dislodge Bitcoin or even come anywhere close.
Mm.
Third thing to note is that Bitcoin has no CEO, no foundation, and has never had a marketing dollar spent on it.
Mm.
And yet the market is telling you that there's something very interesting there.
The fact that there are transactions, the fact that, you know, I think it's something like 93% of volume has been traded in one way or the other in recent times, right? It isn't static. It isn't just sort of sat there.
Mm-hmm.
There is something, to your point, that is happening, that there's value being created one way or the other. I just actually a quick kind of side point within sort of that wider crypto space. How do you then look at sort of Ethereum and Ether versus Bitcoin or alongside Bitcoin? I mean, does that sort of come into play as well?
No, generally the same. I don't find it interesting at all. At best, I would say it's a scam.
Okay.
At worst, I would say it's probably a state-sponsored attack on the Bitcoin network.
Interesting. Okay.
I mean, no country or institution will ever adopt the Ethereum standard like they have adopted the Bitcoin standard.
Okay.
And we should probably get, you know, a little bit into Bitcoin and what makes it so special. But just to conclude the point on Ethereum, no nation state will ever adopt the Ethereum standard because the way it works is that insiders have control over what transactions are valid on the network.
Mm-hmm.
So it's no better than the existing system.
Okay, so it's no different from spinning up a Web 2 style database and transacting through a platform.
Right, and if you're a country, why would you outsource your sovereignty to a bunch of opaque actors on a financial network that can be censored for whatever reason? It's just the same as the existing network where, you know, the Americans decide that they don't like some country or nationality and then they block them out of the SWIFT or Fedwire network.
Mm-hmm.
Ethereum is exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just less transparent who runs or who owns the economic clout on that network to be able to censor transactions.
Yeah.
The point about Bitcoin is that it's an uncensorable monetary network. So anybody can transact with anybody without the permission of anybody else on that network. That's what makes it so interesting. And that's why Bitcoin has been adopted by countries. And our bet is that it will continue to be.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about that in a second as well. But and to your point, we have to kind of, I guess, unravel a little bit about what Bitcoin is and how it works and what sort of can be built on top of it and why things should be built on top of it. But can you share a little bit about your perspective on, you know, the energy consumption of Bitcoin, which tends to be one of the major arguments against its use, right? So if, as you believe, Bitcoin is an integral part of the future financial infrastructure, does that problem not need to be resolved, or do you feel that that resolves itself over time?
I would say no, the problem doesn't need to be resolved because it's not a problem. So, you know, at the outset, I would just make the point that energy usage is synonymous with human flourishing. Mm-hmm. If we try to minimize energy consumption, what results is just civilizational decline, misery, poverty, and sickness. Mm-hmm. Everything we do requires energy. So, for example, if you want to travel to the US, you take a plane, you don't take a kayak, right? Like, the plane is more energy consumptive, but it vastly improves your quality of life. Mm-hmm. Same when, you know, you want to wash the dishes at home, you have a dishwasher instead of doing it by hand. All these things are energy consumptive, but they make things better for everybody. So the objective shouldn't be to minimize energy consumption, but perhaps the objective is to use energy in a way that doesn't destroy the planet.
Yeah, that's a fair question. So that's I guess that's the point, right? Is yes, I agree that you know, taking a plane is far more efficient for me personally than getting on a kayak, but it equally has an impact on climate, on resources, et cetera, right? And all of which are finite, at least in terms of planetary resources, right? Extra planetary resources, we don't know, and this is why people are looking to, you know, get to Mars and so on and so forth. So how do you kind of reconcile the fact? So I would agree that consumption is a sign of progress. For me, at the very least, it doesn't feel that consumption is necessarily the goal, because we're seeing in the West that, you know, as overly consumptive sort of civilizations, we are actually we're having second and third order effects, whether it's around health, whether it's around climate change, et cetera, et cetera. So surely if proponents of Bitcoin and Bitcoin itself is to be sort of the de facto standard potentially, then to your point, managing that consumption efficiently has to be key, because it is something that a lot of people are concerned about, not just with Bitcoin, but just in general anyway, right?
I think it depends what you're referring to consumption of. If it's consumption of energy, then I think we can address that point with Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a non-rivalrous energy demander. Mm-hmm. It doesn't compete.
It's not taking it from anything else.
It's not because you can't just plug a Bitcoin miner into your house and it just wouldn't be profitable. You'd be losing money. You have to look for lower cost sources of energy. Mm-hmm. So essentially the Bitcoin network incentivizes a global hunt for the lowest cost source of energy 24/7. Mm-hmm. And that has interesting second and third order consequences on human civilization, human society. I'll give you one. So, you know, let's say we're concerned about climate change and we want to incentivize production and rollout of green energy. Green energy, in particular solar and wind, have very specific problems that make it challenging to run a modern industrial society, namely that they produce energy in an intermittent fashion. Mm-hmm. So you get loads of energy when the sun is shining or the wind is blowing, and none otherwise. Mm-hmm. And so you wouldn't want to power a baby incubator, for example, on wind power. You need steady power. And so when you have loads of excess energy, it's not actually cost efficient to store it in a battery, mm-hmm. because a battery will bleed after 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And batteries are really expensive. And so you end up having a load of energy that you can't do anything with. You can't put it into the grid because then you get brownouts. And so that energy typically just gets wasted. Mm-hmm. But because the Bitcoin network is a 24/7 willing buyer of energy, these renewable energy producers can sell their excess energy to the Bitcoin network.
In turn, making them more efficient and therefore more profitable and therefore more viable.
You improve the marginal economics of renewable energy stations globally. Yeah. Yeah. So that's one really interesting thing. The second is that the Bitcoin network or Bitcoin mining acts as a way to bootstrap industry in any given area. Mm. So let's say across Africa, you have all sorts of sources of energy, but they may be isolated. You can only move energy, you know, roughly 500 miles or so. And so you have this isolated pocket of energy. There's no center of industry nearby, no civilization to sell it to. It ends up going unmonetized. With the Bitcoin network, all you need is a shipping container, mm-hmm. some AC units, mining rig, and an internet connection, and you can begin to monetize that energy. Mm-hmm. And you can use that as a way to bootstrap industry in that area because you build out the energy infrastructure, right? So they're the sorts of use cases that we're seeing quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I think the public understanding maybe of those use cases or those options or opportunities are probably limited. And I think, I feel like, and I might be wrong here, I feel like a lot of discourse around potentially these sort of positive factors, at least as far as Bitcoin is concerned, have been lost in the wider sort of debate around crypto. And obviously the hubris, I guess, over the last few years where we ended up with, you know, NFTs and so on, which frankly, again, I've had limited understanding of where the value is for those sort of products. I kind of understand a little bit around, you know, okay, they can be a membership token or whatever, but yep, they've never felt to me to be anything more than a fun project rather than a transformative technology.
Can I make just two quick points there?
Yeah,
just on the, just to round off this energy question. The other thing I would say is that the Bitcoin network grants private property rights to every single individual on the planet. And so that, to me, is a great use of energy, even if we wanted to argue that we need to minimize energy consumption as a, in and of itself, in absolute terms. So I think that's really important.
What do you mean by private property rights?
Well, Bitcoin is a digital bearer asset, which means that it's an asset with no counterparty risk. It's mm-hmm. an asset that you can hold without needing any middlemen to intermediate that relationship for you.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike cash,
like gold.
Your cash is in a bank, your gold is in a vault.
Yeah.
The counterparty holds that cash or that gold. And so, you know, what a bank does in effect is it's basically a leveraged bond fund. Bank takes your money and then they go and lend it to the US government or the British government or whatever. And if the value of those bonds is decreased, then, you know, you're out of luck, as we saw in the US over the last few months. Bitcoin has none of those relationships. Bitcoin, like you can own it. Essentially, with 12 words in your head, mm-hmm. you have your Bitcoin, and mm-hmm. you can access it from anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you lost everything, like absolutely everything, as long as you have those 12 words in your head, you can go anywhere in the world and you can access your Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So that's probably worth bearing in mind. And then on your other point, which was, I think, around why there's so much misinformation, I think it's important to sort of understand what the long-term objective essentially of Bitcoin is, which is it's essentially a movement to separate money and state.
Yeah.
And so you're going to get a lot of noise and a lot of misinformation because there's a lot of vested interests in seeing that not happen.
So we're going to talk about that now because this is where I think, certainly from my perspective, I think there are some very, very interesting opportunities ahead. I think, you know, if I think about, you know, some of these emerging currencies that we're now starting to hear about, whether that's in central in sort of various pockets of Africa, whether that is the BRICS currency that was kind of, you know, discussed at the recent sort of forum. But, you know, it'd be great to understand your thoughts on the adoption of Bitcoin as legal tender in countries like El Salvador, Central African Republic. And then I guess, like, what are the implications that their adoption has for Bitcoin? And how far away are we from governments launching their own CBDCs, right? Because in my mind, exactly to your point, right, if Bitcoin does away with the need for state-sponsored fiat currency, essentially, which is the argument, when states see that, surely their first reaction is going to be, well, how do we create a digital currency to maintain our state sponsorship? And actually, the dystopian kind of consequences of a state-sponsored CBDC, to me, are very clear. You know, if you think about things like UBI, which have been spoken about, so universal basic income, if you imagine a government saying, we are going to pay your UBI with our currency, right, with our digital currency, they can then cap or limit where you can transact that currency. So, you know, if you are a smoker, we're not going to allow you to spend it on cigarettes. If you are, you know, this can only be spent on food, not on, I don't know, going to the cinema or whatever it might be, right? So I think there's a lot of kind of potential issues there. So yeah, it'd be great to kind of understand your thoughts on all of that. I know that's a fairly broad and large topic, but that's what we're here for.
Yep. You'll have to prompt me as we go along.
No, please.
In case I forget some of the points, but maybe if we start with El Salvador and then we'll move on to CBDCs, because that might be an indication of how Western countries will try to respond.
Yeah.
So El Salvador is interesting, and there's many countries in a similar situation. If you take the case of El Salvador, they're essentially a sort of collapsing, anarchic society. You know, highest murder rate, highest homicide rate in the world. They had no currency of their own that they could support, because who wants to hold El Salvador?
It was all pegged to the US, yeah.
And so they just used dollars. Problem with using the US dollar is that the US administration, current one and probably the previous one as well, but it's been very apparent under the current one, it's made it very clear that the US dollar is politicized. So if you don't, you know, uphold the political virtues of whatever the administration in the US value, then you're cut out or you'll be disadvantaged within that system. That's one point. The second is, if the US government prints a load of money and you're operating on the US dollar standard, you have to deal with the resulting inflation, but you don't get the benefit of the money printing. You know, they're not funding infrastructure in your country.
Yeah.
They'll be doing it to, you know, support a war abroad, or, you know, build whatever they want to build in the US. And so really, as the El Salvadorian government, you don't really have much of a you've outsourced your sovereignty. Like, yeah, you just don't have any. So if you're El Salvador, what options do you have? It's the dollar. It's another nation state's currency, like the renminbi, but the Americans presumably never going to let that happen so close to the US. You can do your own currency, but it's just going to hyperinflate pretty quickly, most likely. Or you opt, for the first time in history, for a neutral monetary standard that nobody can manipulate or control, that everybody has free and fair access to. And that's what they did. They went with Bitcoin. The rollout itself was probably a little botched. They tried to enforce a local wallet to be used called Chivo. It had all sorts of technical problems. That did slow down Bitcoin adoption in the country. But now, the fact of the matter is, if you go to El Salvador, which I have done, you can go to McDonald's and you can pay for your Big Mac with Bitcoin instead of any other currency. They still take dollars, but they also take Bitcoin. If you stay in a hotel, you can pay in Bitcoin. If you take an Uber, you pay in Bitcoin. So it is, Bitcoin is nation state, and it has changed the perception of the country quite markedly. It's in the press all the time. They've paid off their IMF loans. It's the fastest growing country in the region at 10%. I suspect maybe the next 12 to 18 months, you'll see another Latin American country do something similar. My guess would be Guatemala. And you'll have another other countries in that region. But it's just kind of the game theoretic nature of Bitcoin nation state adoption. You see it be successful, you're going to want to copy it.
Yeah.
And it will be successful because it's just a free, open source monetary protocol that anybody's free to use and engenders innovation.
But isn't, and I guess this goes back to kind of some of the nation ideas around Bitcoin, or some of the conceptual challenges, right? Which is, one is the volatility, right, of Bitcoin itself. So if you're a nation state like El Salvador, right, where presumably majority of the population is living kind of, you know, at the poverty line or thereabouts, majority of them are going to be spending whatever their available resources are on food and staples, right? But if you're seeing large sort of fluctuations in the value of Bitcoin, and obviously, to your point, I guess the logic will be, well, are we going to support the same volatility in our own currency, or in potentially the adoption of another currency like the US dollar? So is this the best of sort of two evils, as opposed to, you know, as opposed to, but I guess, you know, the question is, if that volatility is quite rampant, then that could cause problems, I guess, for local consumption, right?
Yeah. So, okay, two things on this. For your day-to-day transactions, being exposed to Bitcoin is not ideal. Completely appreciate that, because it is volatile, and it's volatile in both directions.
Yeah.
It can go up quickly, it can go down quickly. It is, however, the best performing asset in human history. So over a long enough time period, you know, let's say your time horizon is 4 years, then it's basically the best mechanism humans have ever had to build capital. And that's what's important for poor countries. Like, they're not poor because they don't work hard. They're poor because they have no vehicle to build and develop capital.
No store of value.
There's no property rights.
Yeah.
Can't buy gold. Mm-hmm. They don't have access to US tech stocks or US government bonds. And their local currency is collapsing. So this is the first time in human history that they have access to a store of value that is digital, that can't be seized, that's uncensorable, that they can own with 12 words in their head, and they can save a little bit every week. and it's a mechanism for them to build capital for the first time. Going back to your previous point around volatility in like day-to-day transactions, that's true. There's a bunch of solutions that we funded that allow individuals to, say, hold $100 in Bitcoin pegged to the dollar, but then just transact over the Bitcoin Rails layer, which is just more efficient and cheaper than, say, Visa, MasterCard, who may not even operate in El Salvador. Yeah. So there's ways around that.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing for me there, I mean, just as you're speaking, like, the thought that was going through my head is, I mean, we're basically returning it, in a sense, to pre the invention of modern banking, right? Where essentially everything was transacted in gold, then you had or gold or an equivalent, but then you had nation states, whether that was governments, whether that was more often than not sort of royalty, watering down and diluting the gold and therefore inflating the value, etc. Essentially what you're saying is, this is that, but without the opportunity to dilute, because we know that Bitcoin has a fixed supply, a capped supply and a fixed supply. And to your point, can't be stolen from you, can't be seized, etc. So we're essentially returning to the roots of what it, the first kind of monetary systems, but without all of the challenges that those monetary, well, at least a lot of the challenges that those monetary systems actually had in terms of those sort of specific problems.
Yeah, I think that's true. So that's why Bitcoin is referred to as digital gold.
Yeah.
Humanity essentially settled on gold over, 5,000, 10,000, whatever, however many thousand of years of debating what the best form of money was, and quite clearly settled on gold. Problem with gold is that it can't move at the speed of information. So that's where fiat money came in. Banks, central banks, government said, give us your gold, we'll give you this paper currency. We promise it's pegged to the gold. And then you can transact with that fiat currency because, it also became digital at the speed of information. You want to settle a trade between the US and the UK, your gold's in a bank, you have this paper currency, this digital currency, you can make that transaction at the speed of information, and then the banks will settle with each other at the end of the day. The problem is that obviously the temptation to break the peg between gold and the fiat currency is too large, and they did that, and money printing results, which leads to inflation, which is essentially just theft of resources from the individual level.
Yeah, it's just eroding the value of your own source. So then, how does that then, or will that not then lead to kind of the CBDC? I mean, I was talking to someone recently, I don't know how accurate this is or not, but he's a pretty smart guy. He had created a CBDC, which I think is owned by the UAE or one of the Middle Eastern states. It was essentially bought out by them, but hasn't been implemented. But I think he said to me something like over 90% of world of countries in the world have already planned, their CBDC or have created their CBDCs. I guess the question is, it'll be first mover. Whoever moves first, will be followed pretty quickly. I don't think anyone's going to necessarily do it straight off their own back. But surely that would be, if I'm Joe Biden, if I'm Rishi Sunak, like, my biggest concern is, or not my biggest concern, one of my concerns would be, if Bitcoin replaces sterling, I no longer have control. Surely it's better for me to launch my own digital currency.
Right. So CBDC stands for Central Bank Digital Currency, just in case anybody listening wasn't aware of that. First point to make would be that the currency is already digital.
Sure.
So I think the question is, what are the other incentives to why they would want to launch a CBDC? My sense is, and I'm debating someone from the Bank of England on this next week, is that the Treasury wants there to be a CBDC. They've made their decision. They've probably done quite a lot of work on it already. And they're just waiting for the right political climate to announce it, and a minister who's sort of pliable enough to get it done. Seems to be how most decisions are made in the British government. It's a civil service that really decides.
Yeah, they push.
And on a CBDC, the entire point is just control. You already alluded to it earlier in your introduction. CBDC would just allow for granular control of individual spending patterns. There's really no other reason for one. The pound is already digital. You can clearly transact with it over the internet. The CBDC would just allow for them to say, well, you've exceeded your personal carbon quota. No more flights, no more meat for you this week. Or you know, you attended a protest that we didn't like, and so you're not allowed to spend money outside of 3 miles outside of your house for the next 2 months, you know, by way of punishment. And it all seems kind of drastic, but the point is that the CBDC would allow for that level of control over the individual were it to be implemented. And so, you know, maybe Rishi's too nice a guy and he'd never do it. But in 20 years, you know, you're going to be sure that you got a government that's still as, you know, friendly and nice as Rishi.
Or move to China immediately and see what it's like already. And that's without a digital coin, right. Albeit that they will be releasing one, I think, pretty soon.
Right. Yeah. So it's just, I think everybody's going to have a choice over the next 10 years or so, whether they support something like Bitcoin or a CBDC. And Bitcoin's really the only game in town in opposition to something like a CBDC.
So then, and I guess this may be getting a little bit esoterical and potentially a bit beyond the scope of the podcast today, but I mean, in that sort of a situation, right, as a citizen, I live and operate in the UK, right? Mm-hmm. I have a business that is dependent on clients that also work and operate in the UK, and I'm paid in pounds sterling and so on and so forth. And you know, my employees are paid in pounds sterling. Like, if the UK were, using the UK as an example, if there was a central bank digital coin issued and that became essentially the main kind of currency of use, how could I make the decision to, rather than use that, use Bitcoin? Because if that becomes the widely adopted standard in the UK, right, surely it becomes very, very hard to push back. You know, if I'm the only person using Bitcoin, obviously you're assuming that most people would actually, you know, resist that push. My kind of gut is that most people are lazier in their thinking and will probably just go with the flow, right? And do, as we've seen often, you know, what is most expedient for them today rather than what is most sensible for them for the future. How does one then think about, well, okay, if my choice is the CBDC or Bitcoin, but Bitcoin is going to be problematic because there just aren't enough people using it, because the CBDC solves all the problems that Bitcoin does. Again, there's a couple of additional things that I don't have to think about now, because I'm never going to be in the position where, you know, I'm going to go out and, you know, rob a bank and therefore have my movements restricted. How does one stop the CBDC and use Bitcoin instead, I guess, is the question, right? How does one ensure that Bitcoin becomes a standard rather than whatever the state decides they want?
Right. Well, so a CBDC won't solve the problems that Bitcoin solves. Mm-hmm. The problems that Bitcoin solves is a fixed cap supply, and so your purchasing power is all but guaranteed to go up over a long enough time horizon. CBDC is just an extension of the pound.
So they'll continue to print.
They'll continue to print it, yeah. And so your purchasing power, if you held your wealth in the fiat, the political currency units of your local jurisdiction, will just continue to diminish over time, as they have over the last 100 years. So if you measure your purchasing power as against a scarce desirable asset like a home, over the last, I think it's like 90 years, the US dollar has declined in value by 99.9%.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's the best performing fiat currency. Everything else has declined by 99.99% or 100% in the case of like Zimbabwe or Weimar Germany. So your fiat currency will continue to debase, because that's how governments finance their spending programs. It's just a hidden tax. And a CBDC will just exacerbate that by allowing for inflation and allowing for granular control. It will look very attractive when it's released, because they'll say, open up an account with the Bank of England, have your CBDC, we'll pay you, you know, £1,800 a month in UBI, and you can get, you know, 5% if you leave your money here. But you're just captured to that system.
Yeah.
In opposition to that is Bitcoin, fixed supply, can't be debased, can't be controlled, you can transfer it with no permissions. It just guess you gotta start using it, you gotta educate yourself. There'll be jurisdictions around the world that are very friendly to it, there already are.
Mm.
It's up to Brits to decide which path they want to take, I suppose.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes. They've made a number of decisions over the last 6-7 years, which I wouldn't necessarily agree with, but nonetheless, we are going down those paths. So you wrote, the price of the Bitcoin token may oscillate with macro convulsions and the unraveling of vaporware across the crypto landscape, but the Bitcoin time chain will continue to do what it was built to do. issue a new block every 10 minutes with the updated property rights of everyone who chooses to use it. It is an object of permanence and peerless reliance in an increasingly uncertain world. So where do you see the future?
Well, my general view is that Western governments are pretty much insolvent. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's much of a secret now. Just spent too much money, and they can't pay that money back, especially with rates increasing. And so the future for a lot of these countries, including, unfortunately, the UK, is just a state of continued inflation.
Mm-hmm. Just keep printing money, paying down debt.
Just keep printing money. Yeah. And the problem with money printing is that it leads to increasing inequality. That's why inequality gets worse, because the people who benefit from the money printing are those who are closest to the money printer. So the banks, the large institutions, they get the money first, they get to buy assets, then they get to benefit of the increased value of those assets in nominal terms, and everybody else...
Everyone who's spending their money basically suffers, yeah.
Yeah. And so that's really the future for the next 5 to 10 years. I don't really see a way out of that. They just have to print money. Currency is always just the error term when there's too much debt in the system. In stark contrast to this is what I would term as essentially an entirely new civilization. But the civilization is not in physical space. It's in digital space. It's Bitcoin. And so basically you have two civilizations competing with one another right now. Mm-hmm. You have your fiat civilization, fiat ecosystem, and your Bitcoin civilization. And at the root of each civilization is a ledger. And that ledger just records the property rights of that civilization. And the question each civilization asks is, who gets root access to that ledger? And so in the fiat ecosystem, it's the nation state.
It's the government, yeah.
They get to manipulate it at will. And in the Bitcoin ecosystem, it's the individual. Everybody has access to that ecosystem, and nobody else can manipulate it. Now, the problem in the fiat ecosystem is that when you have this ledger that the nation state can corrupt, on top of that ledger is what I would call an institutional stack. So it's your governments, your universities, banks, payment processors, everything. And when you have corruption in the ledger, you have corruption throughout that institutional stack. In the sort of Bitcoin world and the Bitcoin civilization, you have a ledger that cannot be corrupted, but the institutional stack has to get built. And that's what TimeChain exists to do. We're trying to fund and seed the institutional stack on top of the Bitcoin ledger. And then if anybody ever wants to move over from, you know, this fiat world to the Bitcoin world, then they're free to do so, because it's a free and open monetary network that nobody's forced to use, but anybody can use if they choose it.
I think this is... The biggest problem I see, right? Well, the biggest challenge I see is always mass adoption requires understanding. I think most people have not necessarily educated themselves on the benefits, the potential challenges, the issues. I would include myself in that cohort of people as well. I understand enough, but probably not near enough, if I can put it that way, of you know, what the potential of Bitcoin could be, and also have probably made the mistake of conflating it a lot with the broader crypto and mm-hmm. blockchain kind of craziness over the last several years. What would you recommend to people? I mean, other than obviously listening to this episode of this podcast, what would you recommend to people who really want to understand, where is a good place for them to really start to understand the value, and I mean, you know, not in monetary terms, but the value of Bitcoin, right? The reason, the raison d'etre of Bitcoin. Should they be reading the white paper? Should they be looking at some other resource? Where is the best place for them to get a good feel, a good understanding at a base level that they can then build from?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's always good to read the white paper. It's actually not particularly technical. Mm-hmm. But I would recommend a book called The Bitcoin Standard. You can buy it on Amazon. Mm-hmm. It's not, should be particularly expensive. Mm-hmm. And just to read that as a good starting point. But I think it's also worth noting that, you know, people don't have to achieve the level of understanding that, you know, we tried to get to on this podcast. Really, Bitcoin at its core is very simple. It's just a supply capped money. There's 21 million of them, and they could be moved around the world at the speed of light with next to no fees in a completely permissionless fashion. Nobody can take them from you unless you willingly give them up. Nobody can censor your transactions. It is a superior asset to gold and a superior network to Fedwire, Swift, Visa, and MasterCard. And they're the two dimensions on which we think about it, an asset and a monetary protocol.
Mm.
And we just fund the infrastructure that allows people, individuals, institutions, and nation states to utilize it as an asset or a monetary protocol. That's it.
Simple as that. Alex, amazing. I can kind of feel the need to dive a lot deeper into a lot of this. I have no doubt that we'll have more conversations over time. In the meantime, for our listeners, where's the best place for them to find you? You're online, you're on LinkedIn, Twitter. Where's the best place for them to come looking for you?
Yeah, LinkedIn, Alexander Mann, and Twitter, it's at Alex_Singh, S-I-N-G-H, _Mann, M-A-N-N.
Amazing. Alex, thank you again for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks so much.